Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Well, Ray Martin needs no introduction. We're all familiar with his phenomenal television career, but his new autobiography, called Ray, Stories of My Life, goes beyond that public persona to reveal a turbulent childhood, a devoted mother, an Aboriginal family heritage, and a lifelong love affair with his wife, Diane. And of course, there are the expected behind-the-scenes details of his interactions with the rich and famous, like Princess Diana. I spoke to Ray Martin at his publisher's offices recently in a very enjoyable conversation that explored his childhood, his career, his regrets, and even God.
Well, Ray Martin, it really is a privilege to be able to have this time with you.
Oh, my pleasure, Sharon.
It must be interesting, after all of these years of being the interviewer, to then collate all of those years of experience and your own personal story into a book, and quite a sizable book.
Yeah, it's a bit like giving birth, I suspect. And it was a 9-month gestation period, really, but I suppose 64 years in the making.
And you have been on quite a grueling schedule of interviews. What's that like now? I mean, you've done this before, and yet probably not to this degree.
No, nothing like this. In fact, most times I'm sitting where you are, and I'm asking the questions, and I'm much more comfortable asking questions rather than answering. Similarly, even writing the book, it's been not therapeutic, not even cathartic to write the book, but it's been kind of pleasing and satisfying to put those sort of jigsaw puzzles together in one picture of my life, if you like, a timeline of my life, my childhood, and that's been good. But talking about it is funny, because I mean, certainly people who read the early stuff think it's somewhere between Albert Facey and A Fortunate Life and Angela's Ashes, and it was neither. There was neither. My memory of my childhood, despite the troubles, was of something quite wonderful.
Yes. Well, that's what I actually was struck by when I read through parts of the book, is just simply the early years, which probably a good deal of us wouldn't have even expected from the Ray Martin that we've seen on the television for so many years. I mean, no. It was a chaotic childhood in the sense of moving from place to place because of your father and his alcohol addiction.
Yeah, it was probably his jobs and the itinerance was more, he was a fitter and turner and a mechanic. And after the war, the Second World War, there were plenty of jobs, and so he could get a job anywhere. And I don't know why he was so footloose and fancy free, but the end result was my three sisters, who were older than me, and my mother and he, we went everywhere. We went to 13 different towns in 3 different states before I even started high school. And to me, it was a bit of a boy's own adventure, without exaggerating it. But for my sisters, who were older, including teenage years, it was quite traumatic, and their experience was different to mine. But mine was this wonderful thing of jumping on and off trains and, you know, living in the bush in the country in Australia and loving it.
But there are also some of those difficult moments too.
He clearly was an alcoholic because of the violence that came and because of the regularity of his drinking. But much of the time he was a good father and a very gentle and a very intelligent and a very sort of caring bloke. I don't know why I've spoken since I wrote the book. A lot of people have told me of similar sort of experiences, you know, variations on the same theme. I don't know whether these blokes who came back from World War II were traumatised by what they'd done. He didn't go to war, but he was in the Air Force, and certainly had mates who were lost, etc. I don't know whether that was the case. A lot of people have said this to me, but whatever the reason, there's no excuse, for violence against women or children, and that was the end result, and so many men were guilty of it, and are still guilty.
Mm-hmm. And there was one particular moment in the story, your story, where your mother really had to arrange an escape.
Yeah, as happens with domestic violence, it seems that it starts to unravel, it just starts to get worse. And we're talking about the 1950s, and so there was no real support system. There was, the churches didn't support abandoned or single mums at that stage, and there was no welfare system really to support. So often women stayed in that terrible relationship because of the kids and because they had nowhere else to go. Well, mum was brave enough to make the move, and she'd been, the domestic violence was becoming far too common, and it used to be at least verbal violence, if not physical violence, had been every, once a week. And then it increased. And so with the support of my sisters, she decided to make a break, and the two elder girls were now working and independent, and so my next sister Joyce, who was 3 years older than me, and my mother and I then fled, and we literally fled, and we went to Central and caught a train to Adelaide, and that was about as far away as we could go from Sydney without crossing the Nullarbor. And we changed our name at that stage. Mum was worried that that my father, maybe a private detective, would find where we'd gone. And to go interstate, you had to fill out a form, even at Central. And so we just filled out basically a ticket form. And so she grabbed the name Martin, which was, we laugh about it, we don't quite know where it was, but it may have been for a laxative or something, at the station, God knows. And so we changed it, which was meant to be a temporary change, and it became almost part of the persona. I can't imagine being anyone else but Ray Martin now. But you know, as dramatic as that is, I guess every woman who changes her name when she marries goes through the same thing. And we have lots of new Australians, and they suddenly find they become Brown or Smith or something else, and they lose their name. So maybe names are not what they're out to be.
You cracked up to be. When we've spoken to people like Geraldine Doogue or Caroline Jones, it's been so interesting to look at the early childhood experiences of somebody who's then had such an influence in the media and to trace that back to the current day impacts. When you look back at those early years, whether it be the constant moving with your dad's choosing of different jobs or indeed fleeing from his dangerous ways in the end, I mean, he was actually shooting at you from at one stage, wasn't he?
Yeah, we don't think he shot at us, but certainly in the night he got a gun and we raced away in the bush and across a paddock, and he fired the gun, but none of us thought that he fired against us, you know, because again, I hadn't been violated, my sisters weren't. He wasn't brutal to us, and he was, you know, really rarely brutal to Mum, but it was this violence of the tongue, and it was the bullying that that men do in these domestic violence situations that makes life impossible.
Okay, so where does that leave you? Well, how did that shape you or change you, those early moments, when you then look back at who you were shaped to be in those early years and who you've become? Can you see any trace?
I don't think I can, and maybe a psychiatrist or psychologist might find something there. I honestly don't feel that there's any chip on the shoulder. I don't feel that there's any lasting problems that I've had with fathers or men or domestic situations. I think the saving grace was my mother. My mother was extremely strong, left school at 13 as my dad did, so there's no education there, no support system, but whatever it was, she was simply a wonderful mother, and she believed that that I could do anything, as the girls could, if we wanted to. And of course, you know, when you're poor, that's a wonderful dream. But she worked in a knitting mill in Launceston overtime for all my high schooling, and just to make sure that I had the chance. And on one occasion, I was going to leave school at 15, as my three sisters did, and go and get a job, as you could. And she was so upset with me that she didn't talk to me for 3 days. And she basically had said, look, you know, I've worked my fingers to the bone here to give you a chance, and you want to throw it away. And of course, when your mother doesn't talk to you for 3 days, that's the only time she'd, you know, she'd certainly never abuse, never hit me for anything, and loved me dearly. So I did what she wanted me to do, and I'm so glad I did, because, you know, we figured that out of an Irish Catholic working class Australian family, that there must have been about 200 kids on both sides, my mum's side and my dad's side, of the generations since they first came in the 1830s from Ireland, and I think I was the first to go to university.
Ray Martin is with us on Open House, the Open House .net.au for the podcast of our chat. So, Ray, the first glimmer that maybe journalism should actually be it, when you actually have that opportunity to get a university, when did that come?
Well, it's funny, I was at Launceston High School, which is a selective school in northern Tasmania, and my best mate and I got the job of running the school newspaper, being editor of the school newspaper, and also running the school radio station. Now, that sounds more impressive than it really was. Running the school radio station was all we would do, would handle the assemblies, the microphones at assemblies, and we'd also play a classical music track, which the headmaster would cue for us. But
I was going to say, you didn't even get to cue the song.
No, not at all. He would simply say, sort of cue. And we'd sit in a small room, which is like a booth with a record player and microphone controls, fairly primitive. But our mates would sit out in the assembly hall, and they'd sort of try and stay asleep from that, you know, REM stage of sleep, as you sit out there in the cold of the assembly being bored. And we had reasonably comfortable seats inside. And as far as editing the newspaper is concerned, I played a lot of sports, so I was the sports editor, and I got to write a lot about my sporting prowess and my mates. And John Honey, the other fellow who was with me, he did the news stuff for the newspaper and the magazine at the end of the year. So that was what it extended to. But he went on to become the first director of the Tasmanian movie trying to think what it was called, but anyway, a Tasmanian feature film, and he also was heavy, very heavy in the ABC in Hobart, and he then went on to become a documentary maker, and I went my way. So you'd swear that these two young blokes had, you know, had their sights set on a career when they're in high school, but really what we're trying to do is avoid classes.
Wow, yeah, there you are.
And succeeded.
And so when you got that first phone call from the ABC, or...
Manganini was the name of his film.
Good stock. Yeah. Good details in the end. So when that phone call did come from the ABC, when you did get that job as a correspondent, that must have felt just amazing.
It did feel amazing. I had no idea. I applied as a cadet at the ABC, and I went in for an interview, and I didn't know how I'd done. I remember I had to read a news bulletin, which was fairly short, and that was kind of funny. And then I had to do an interview with one of the more senior fellows there. And I remember I messed it up a bit. I stumbled a bit over it, and he was kind enough to say to me, "Do you want to do that again?" And I said, "Yes, please." And so we did it again. I wonder, had they kept the first one, whether I would have been, you know, never got the job. But then for that first day, I couldn't believe, even though I wasn't making much money, that they'd pay me to do something like this. I was working in radio, and it was exciting, and, you know, we were doing broadcasts on the ABC, and I'm not sure anyone was listening in some of those programs, but it seemed great fun. And then within 4 years, I was offered a job as the New York correspondent. And so I went off with, we'd just been married, and I went off with Diane to New York for 10 years. And suddenly the world opened up, and suddenly I was in the Middle Kingdom, as the Chinese say, and everything happened in New York, or revolved around Washington and New York. And I, again, couldn't believe, used to pinch myself thinking the two of us would say, Diane and I would say, you know, can you believe someone's paying us to be here and see this and experience this? And we couldn't. And it was the same as 60 Minutes. It was the same in Midday and et cetera. So it's been a very fortunate life.
Okay. What was the pinch yourself moment then for both your time as the New York correspondent with the ABC and then with the 60 Minutes program?
Oh, geez, you're not. I mean, there are a dozen times, there are 50 times when it would happen. I mean, seriously, I used to think, you know, being in China, being in, you know, talking to presidents of the United States, being in you know, a million people in an anti-Vietnam War moratorium, one night just around the Pool of Reflection in Washington, and a million people sort of stretched out there who were ready for a big march, and the president of the United States, Richard Nixon, came down about 4 o'clock in the morning to talk to some of the demonstrators, and I was further up in the, I didn't see him come down, but the word quickly spread like brush fire, that the president had come down. I think he was at, you know, really quite a manic, paranoid state at that stage, the president was, and he'd come down to try and talk sense into these demonstrators. And I went and talked to some of those who talked to him, and they'd been strangely respectful of the president who'd come down to see them. And that was it was something like out of a Costa Gravas movie, one of these sort of you know, European movies where the president appears with his manservant and talks to the rebels and then goes away. And that had really happened. And so it just seemed, you know, being in Harlem one night talking to the Black Panthers, who were regarded then by the FBI as the most dangerous terrorist organisation in the country, and they weren't illegal, but they'd had a couple of clashes with police, and police had died, and a lot of the Black Panthers had died, and suddenly I found myself travelling in one of their cars to the South Bronx, to a place called Fort Apache, which was so dangerous that ambulance drivers and firemen wouldn't go in there anymore because it was just too dangerous. And at a time when New York was, when 2,200 people a year were killed, 2,200 people a year are killed, murdered in New York. New York and Detroit were the most dangerous cities, the murder capitals of America. And so here I was sort of in the worst of that area as a fresh-faced young bloke from Australia at 2 o'clock in the morning, wondering what I was doing there. And yet that's the innocence I think gets a lot of Australians a lot of places. Even as I'm talking to you, these are just wonderful, vivid memories that I've got of this life being a journalist.
Yes, I bet they are. This is Open House right across the nation. Ray Martin has his autobiography out. It's called Ray, Stories of My Life, and this is Open House. What are your non-negotiables when it comes to your journalistic approach, and how have they changed over the years? What events might have shaped the way that you have done your craft over these years?
I say to young journalists that if a story, if you're going to criticise someone, if you're going to really get tough with somebody, make sure you're right. Because young journalists will find, if you're going to stay in the business, that it'll come around and bite you on the backside if, in fact, you don't get your facts right or if you dud somebody. It's okay to be severely critical if it's justified and if you've got the goods. That's one thing, that you make sure you've done your homework and make sure that you've got it right. The other thing so often is, I think the non-negotiables are that no story is worth a life. No story is worth persecuting somebody to the point where they just find that they've no alternative but to take their own life. I mentioned a couple of stories in the book like that. Now, when you set out, and I didn't do the stories, but I was hosting a current affair when one of them happened, and you're left wondering what you should do. When don't you put the blowtorch on somebody? Do you put it on Kerry Packer only, or politicians only, or do you put it on the local store owner who rips people off? Well, I don't know the answer to that. You've got to judge at the time whether it's valid. I mean, someone who, a mechanic who rips off an ordinary person for $150 for a car that doesn't need fixing, $150 to an ordinary person is as much as $1 million to Kerry Packer. And so they're important, and that's where most of the rip-offs occur, is, apart from big business and so on, the multinationals, that sort of charge. But I think so often it is the little guy or the little woman who does that, and few people can afford those. So there is a public service involved in programs that do expose that sort of crime and that sort of fraud, but at the end, in the end, it's not worth the sort of punishment that I'd come out. It brings me on to someone like Lindy Chamberlain. I mean, the public stoning that happened with Lindy Chamberlain. Here is an innocent woman, and no question she was innocent on this. And yet, half the nation, probably more, thought that she was guilty of having killed a child. And she went to jail. Not only did she lose the baby, but she went to jail and lose the baby in a most horrible way. And then she had to somehow recover and get on with life. Well, it shows, it's a testament to her strength and probably her faith as well, that she was able to do that so well. And yet she is probably the bravest woman I met.
Absolutely. And I guess there's a great power in the people who are in the media, any of us, whether it be to the degree that you have had over the years, or whether it be those of us who host smaller programs. There is an immense amount of power there. I mean, you really can sway people's public opinions about people just like Lindy Chamberlain. And like you said, she was innocent, and yet a good deal of Australia was actually against her. I mean, when did you realise that? Was there ever a moment where you had that realisation, I actually have a lot of power here?
I think it was late in life, to be honest, because it was... I honestly wasn't being naive in that, but I just think that I kept thinking, because of my own background, that I was really an ordinary worker in that sense, and I still am. But I think that when people talk to you, and they won't talk to somebody else, when people are available, whether it be politicians or whether it be businessmen or women or academics or sports people, then you realise that you've got the power of attention anyway. That people will, in many cases, use you, use your medium, television or radio, to sell something or to whatever. But beyond that, too, is probably the power of trust. That if someone trusts you enough to talk to you and tell you their stories, then that's a huge responsibility. Then you can't dud them on that. You can't treat them lightly. An issue that isn't very important in the way the world is run is very important to that person's life. And therefore, if they're prepared to tell you their innermost secrets, you've got to use them carefully, and you've got to use them so at the end of the day they don't regret the fact they did it. And so often doing radio or television, I used to talk to people, even on something like Midday, where you'd have an audience sitting in front of them, and they would say things to me on camera that I would think, why are you saying this? Why are you bearing your soul to me? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, whether they just felt the need to talk about it. Very different, though, when we used to get about 1,000 letters a week on Midday, and people regarded the Midday program as their program, and it was, and we'd get 500 or 600 phone calls on some days. A number of times I've referred to in the book, too, where people would write me letters that were the most intimate, most personal revelations, that I couldn't believe that they were doing it. And, we do something, let's say, on incest. And I remember I refer there, but I got a letter, a handwritten letter from a lady who was in her 70s. And she wrote me maybe 16 or 17 pages. I've still got the letter at home, about how she'd been molested by her grandfather for a period of years. And she'd had three children, three girls herself, and a husband, and a long-term marriage, and she'd never told any of them what she went through, this period that she went through as a child. Now, she was telling me, and I was just a character on television. But clearly, A, she needed to tell somebody, and B, she trusted me enough to tell me. Mm. And other people would tell us, you know, things that were happening that occasionally we'd have to quietly try and talk to government departments to help them out because they were in terrible strife and they needed some help. Mm. And they weren't ringing me, they weren't writing to me to get me to get someone to help them, but they just needed to talk to somebody. They needed somewhere to get some help.
To some degree, though, is that the fact that you have been known as the nice guy in media? There is almost a sense of inherent trust there that they feel like they have been able to share those things with you because you haven't had the reputation that some other media hosts have actually had. That's a hard thing for you to respond to, given the fact that I've just given you a big pat on the back.
Yeah, no, if that's the case, I'm pleased. But I've worked at it for a long time in the sense of that I don't think we're brain surgeons, and I don't think we have a right to to molest people. I don't, despite some things that have happened to me, I've never walked into anyone's front door. I've never climbed through a window to hear a story. I've never chased people down the street. In fact, when I was doing A Current Affair, I used to, time after time, tell reporters, look, it's just to chase people with a camera down the street who don't want to talk to you is just rude. Yeah. It's just bad manners.
And I wanted to ask you about that,
it's
actually
not good television. Yeah. And people don't, newspaper journalists don't do it. You walk to talk to someone in an office and they don't want to talk, or you say, well, you know, Mr. So-and-so didn't want to speak or refuse to comment. Mm. On television, to me, it just looks, early on it was theatre. Early on it was this theatre of chasing the alleged crook or the alleged fraudster. And then it became just bad manners. And I think then it became bullying. Mm. And it was cameras could bully people, often people who were quite innocent. And if they saw the camera and were afraid of the camera and turned away, then they looked to be guilty. Mm. And they weren't necessarily guilty. So I had this ongoing battle with some of my colleagues who'd be saying, look, it just doesn't work and it makes us look like we're bullies and we shouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm not going to harangue you about this, but the interesting thing was that I was actually part of an organisation that actually got a Mark Monroe walk-in just before I went to work for them. And the fact was that it actually turned out to be there was nothing to the story at all.
I refer, in fact, to a couple of times where I've known of a walk-in in a factory that was the one next door that wasn't even the one they were chasing. And they walked in on a factory and on one occasion and the people said, what are you talking about? We don't do that. Mm. We haven't got that product. And they said, isn't this so-and-so? And, no, it was the factory next door, et cetera, et cetera. And those sorts of things. And so they do go on, and I think that they're frontline exposed them, and they should have been exposed, but they're also not, they're not the sort of practice that is approved by good journalists, I don't think.
And it's certainly gone now, but at the time when you were hosting the show, when obviously some of these things slipped through, do you look back now with a certain sense of regret?
Oh no, absolutely. And again, hosts get all the praise and they get the big bucks, and therefore they should get the brickbats as well. They should carry it, but these are decisions that are made by the executive producer and the producers as well as the host in this thing. So it's a group thing where a bunch of people who've got a lot of experience in journalism decide this is the way they're going to do it. And to be perfectly honest, and I'm not absolving myself from any of this, but to be honest, there were stories that might appear from Brisbane or Melbourne or even Sydney when I was hosting the programs in which there wasn't time to, I hadn't seen the story. I was out doing something else or, preparing something else, or they came in late and they were...
And so you're presenting it to where? I haven't seen it.
Oh, quite often. I mean, anyone, whether it's Richard Carlton or whether it's Kerry O'Brien or anyone, Tracy Grimshaw now, I mean, the chances of her or these people seeing most of their stories are fairly slim, that they, because they've got their own duties in the day, an executive producer or a producer sees them and they're the ones responsible. So it will collectively, like in a newspaper, we all are to blame, but it's not quite as simple as, how come Ray Martin let that through?
Sure, yeah, sure. This is Open House Across the Nation. Ray Martin is with us. Was there a story? Was there a person? Was there an issue that you've just never had the opportunity to speak to explore, that you just would have loved to, haven't been able to?
Yeah, I guess, the Queen Elizabeth II, would be one of those interviews you'd love to do. As the Pope, I'd love to interview the Pope or the Queen, no matter who they are, which Pope, because to reach that position you have to be a fairly complex and capable character, and therefore complex people are always interesting to talk to, and Popes are obviously complex. And the Queen, similarly, having had her role, even though it's a statutory role and it's a constitutionally controlled role, that it's nevertheless she's been across most of the political and social developments in Britain, if not in the British Commonwealth and around the world, for the last 50, 60 years, maybe longer. But so I think if she was open to talk about her opinion and her reading of certain things, I think it'd be absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. Not just politics, but you know, society as well. Of course, she's never going to do that, and so it won't happen. But that's the dream. Similarly with the Pope. I mean, people of that sort of, if a billion plus people believe in your faith and you're the leader of that faith, then I think you know, all the responsibilities. And I think, as we said about television hosts, anyone who suggests the Pope simply makes a decision and that's it, and he's got to carry it, obviously doesn't know power politics, and yeah. And we know the sort of pressures would be on any pope or any church leader around the world, and the pressures of do this or do that, and if you do that, this is going to happen, the strategies. And so they're not decisions that are made like that. They're not quick decisions. They're decisions that are deeply thought over and usually have their own reason. And so I think they're fascinating. The Frank Sinatras and the Jackie Onassis as well are people who've gone way beyond just being celebrities. They've been involved in music or crime or you know, politics, or you know, married to John F. Kennedy, that sort of. So I think those sort of people are fascinating, and yet I was up in Warialda recently, just on holidays, and driving down to Warialda to the Greek cafe, there was a woman I thought was a Greek woman who served us some toasted sandwiches and coffee, and she was from Iraq, and she was telling me that she'd come across the mountains, gone across the mountains into Turkey, and with a husband and a son and daughter. She's in year 12 and the boy's in year 10, and there she is in this sort of last picture show town of Warialda in New South Wales, and she had done this biblical journey across the mountains and been sent back, and then went back again at night, and they got through Turkey and they got to Greece and they worked there for 3 or 4 years, and then they got their papers and they came to Australia, and I wanted to ask her what she was doing there, and you know, what had driven her, and she was so proud of what Australia offered and so grateful of the opportunity there, and she was running a former Greek cafe in a tiny one-horse town in New
South
Wales.
Such a journalistic heart beating, doesn't it?
Oh, they're fantastic. I mean, and we get them all the time. And I mean, yes. we get people who, compared with my childhood, you know, were in concentration camps, and they've come on and they've had families and generations that have succeeded mightily against those odds, and they've still got the numbers on their arm from the concentration camps, and others who've done these journeys, you know, in leaky boats across the Indian Ocean, and been in detention centres, and now have children doing university, and you know, who'll be in medicine and all those sorts of things. So they're the most wonderful stories, and they're not famous people. These are just people who get out and do it and survive and succeed.
Yes. Now, you had a phone call from somebody else it would be fascinating to talk to, Cardinal George Pell, and the opportunity was there for you, in fact, just, what, 18 months ago then, to be the host of World Youth Day with a potential billion audience.
It was audience. Awesome. And as I said to the Cardinal, look, you know, I'm a lapsed Catholic. I married a Presbyterian in a Presbyterian church. And he said, well, that's good. It shows how ecumenical the Catholic Church is that we would invite you to be the host of this. He said, you know, I'm sure he dealt with far more religious problems than mine. But I saw it as a great challenge, and I also saw it as, even though I'm you know, no longer a regular churchgoer in the Catholic Church, I still felt with so many Australian Catholics, with a third of the country Catholics, etc., that there was I like big events, and clearly wherever the Pope goes, it's a big event. But also it was a great time in Australia, I think, for not just the Catholic Church, but I think for every Christian church, and I think for every other church, to reassess itself and to get some. I think there was some buoyancy, some uplift for all the faiths when you get the leader of a great faith coming to your country and raising questions about social issues and about ethical issues and about moral issues. And that's what happened when, you know, if the leader of the Muslim, of Islam came here, if the leader of any other church came here. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I loved it. It was like covering a moonwalk in the sense that you had to keep talking when nothing was happening. And there was a lot of that. But I think beyond that, what pleased me most of all was that when it was over, I had a number of letters and I ran into a lot of Australian Catholics who had watched it. And they thanked me for, two things. One, of not getting buried in the liturgy and getting buried in the sort of detail of the religion, which would, you know, barely be of interest to Catholics, let alone anybody else. But and that was one, and we didn't try to. But the other one was also not to take cheap shots at the faith, and I was never going to do that. But if people saw it that we had some respect for it, as well as the fact that it had to be television and therefore had to be watchable, and it was such an event. I mean, just as I say, I thought the pictures and the time of day that so many of the masses were on, including the Pope's first mass at Darling Harbour, was like something out of a feature film. It was just the Australian light was glorious, and it was as though someone up there was looking after them.
And probably, may indeed have actually happened.
Probably was.
You mentioned about being a lapsed Catholic. I mean, where would you position yourself these days when it comes to spirituality or a philosophy of life or a religious persuasion? Do you have one?
Oh, well, I do, and I do. I mean, I'm certainly a believer. I suspect that probably, you know, now that I've stopped running a million miles an hour, that I'll probably give it more thought than I have in the past, and that's an excuse, again, rather than a reason. But I certainly support people of whatever faith and their right to that faith and their belief. I don't think anything strange after you conceive the idea of the Holy Sacrament in the Catholic Church, the idea of the body and blood of Christ being in a wafer and wine. If you can accept that, you can accept almost any part of religion, can't you? And any religion. I mean, that's as if you're not brought up on it, then it's almost as bizarre as anything we get from, I don't know, I was going to say Scientology or Islam, etc., which or, you know, the Jewish religion. But in fact, part of faith is believing, and part of faith is, you know, we have our rituals and we've got the reasons for them, and even members of these faiths don't go along with every detail of it often, but they basically are followers and they go along and they care about it. So where would I place myself? I'm spiritual. Accept certainly accept the faith of everybody else and their right to it, and encourage young people and people to have a faith and pursue it. And I'm never embarrassed by someone who talks about God or about their God. And I encourage people to do it. I don't think we certainly would never put anyone down.
And would you personally be leaning towards the Christian God? Would you find yourself be returning, say, to the Catholic faith or Presbyterian now that Diane is in your life, of course, after all these years?
Yeah, no, well, I don't know. I don't know whether I'd probably at an age now where I tend to think that that the literal God that the Catholic Church portrays is not the God that I believe in, but I don't know. You know, I can't speak sensibly and wisely of that God, but I hear, you know, I've done interviews with rabbis, with Jewish rabbis, as I have with Jesuit priests, as I have with, you know, the Dalai Lama or some of the Eastern religious leaders, and I find them. I like the wisdom, and I like the spiritual commitment of these people I've spoken to. There's clearly a skerrick of truth, more than a skerrick of truth, in all these great religions, and I think that it's not coincidental that there are so many similarities in them. I think that's the basis of some true religion, and I don't pretend to be any wiser than that. But I'm impressed with religious leaders who don't say, as Catholic priests used to say to me in my youth, well, you know, when I try to get things explained, they would say to me, well, if you believe, you'll just believe. You know, if you've got faith, you'll understand. Yeah. Well, that's not good enough for me, and it's not good enough for a lot of people. But when I talk to, as I say, to a rabbi who explains his faith and the Jewish faith, then I can see a lot of truth in that. When I talk to, as I say, let's say Jesuits, who are the thinkers so often in the Catholic Church, and they explain their faith and rationalise it, if you like, then I have much more time for that.
Yes. But I think there needs to be a bit of both of that. We need to have an intelligent spirituality. There needs to be something that actually does have a rational basis. And I personally would say that there's some very strong rational arguments for not just the existence of God, but even pointing to the existence of, say, a personal God, in the sense that human beings have got personality. Where did personality come from? Or where does the notion of love come from? It's very interesting that A.N. Wilson, the well-known biographer, who was a very ardent atheist, has recently come to Christian faith. And the thing that he said was that any other materialistic worldview couldn't give an answer for, let me get this right, music, beauty, the order in the world, and love. And I think some of those things actually point to the rational basis for faith, which sounds like what you're looking for.
And the other part of it, Sheridan, that I think as well, I remember doing an interview once with Malcolm Muggeridge, and we did a story about, we went to Lourdes, and we did a story of the faithful who were going to Lourdes for a miracle cure, etc. But we spoke to Malcolm Muggeridge in his early 80s, in his house, I think in Surrey or Kent, and one Saturday afternoon, and we had a born again Christian sound man with us who was committed and in his faith, and there was no wavering, there was no grey area in the faith for this young man. And I sat with Malcolm Muggeridge in the afternoon and over a cup of tea and said, "You know, are you certain?" Because our friend was certain about his faith. And Malcolm Muggeridge said, "No." He said, "The more I study, the more I talk, the more I contemplate, the more questions I ask, the more deeply committed I become." Mm. But as a result of this search, it wasn't something that was simply laid out and here it is, 1 + 1 = God. It wasn't that. It was this search for something with Muggeridge had done. Now, I, in my mind, let alone my heart, I can't accept that all these intelligent men and women whom I've spoken to over the years or listened to or read over the years that they're wrong. I can't believe, I think of the arrogance of atheists to say, "Well, no, that's all wrong, that's all rubbish." Mm-hmm. Tell me more. Tell me why these intelligent people are deluded. Tell me why they're misled. Tell me why they're wrong any more than you're wrong as an atheist. I seem to find more people who are at peace with themselves and at peace with the world who have a faith than those who don't. And I'm generalising here. Of course, there are atheists who are at peace. But generally, I find those who have searched for something and have found something are at peace far more than those who are still, you know, who are sort of out there hanging.
Yes. And last question on the whole religious section of the chat. You know, any words on Jesus? I mean, have you looked into his life or... Again, talking to the Malcolm Muggeridges, whose story actually really revolves around this person, this luminous person, after his documentary, etc.
Well, Ken Duncan as well. I mean, the Australian photographer who's, you know, done the search for Peter and for Paul and for Christ in passing, but, you know, travelled many of their footsteps, taking photographs and trying his own search. I mean, these were extraordinary men, as Jesus Christ was, an extraordinary man, irrespective of one's belief in faith. You don't achieve that sort of stature and that sort of fame and that sort of persuasion if you're just ordinary. Mm. Clearly, I'm an historian, and I love the role that I guess major figures play in social history, in forming our what we are and who we are and where we live and how we live. And clearly this was one of the great figures of eternity, of all history. And so in that sense, he's not to be dismissed is not to be dismissed as someone who just came and went. I mean, there's obviously something else there, and that makes it fascinating.
Well, Ray, it's just been fascinating to talk to you. I mean, one of the things I just want to touch on just before we finish up is this wonderful marriage you've had to Diane. I mean, she gets a lot of tender words in the biography. And it's got to be one of the, unfortunately, sadly, one of the few marriages in media that has not just survived, but it seems to have thrived, if we're to believe half of the words that you've actually written into the book there. It's been a wonderful thing.
Well, I please believe the words, but because they're meant, but the... I guess, you know, she's, while I've been running around chasing stories and not only having a good time, but also trying to interpret some of the things we've seen, she's been the rock, and she's been, even before we had children, she comes from a very stable marriage. Her parents were married for about 55 years until her father died of a heart attack, and so I think that's a grounding. The end result is that Diane's two brothers and her sister, like us, have been married for decades, and they were, you know, four children came out of a very solid marriage.
Beautiful.
And probably we, you know, far more than we ever own up, we're influenced by our parents and by their, you know, what their standards and by their as role models, and so I think she had that wonderful grounding as well, which has sort of helped us. So I give her so much of the credit for our 40 plus years of marriage in that, because she similarly has been apart from being the rock and those things, she also has avoided the publicity, avoided the attention, and perhaps the inflated balloon that goes with television, with the public media. And so she's been able to step aside from that and keep the children out of it, and as well. And so they've been able to live a much more normal life, if you like, than other people in the business maybe. And I think they've benefited from it. But I give her the bulk of the credit for any longevity that's there.
Yes. Well, Ray, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Sharon. Nice to talk to you too.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.